Welcome to Packer Pushers. This is just a impromptu Packer party, and this is the recording of the event. Partly because I wanted to test GoToMeeting to see how it went for just recording these types of things and sharing screens. And also because we were originally scheduled to record this evening, but then we've decided not to. Ethan's away for no apparent reason. He's off, I think, walking around hills and generally doing hiking things and getting unwinding. So I thought I'd just hold this impromptu meeting, see if anybody on the Twitter wants to join in and discuss any topics that make them happy. So there's no agenda here. There's no topics we want to cover. If you want to raise your hand, if you just type in the Q&A window and I'll see your question and then I'll enable your microphone. If I enable your microphone, you will need to notice that you'll have to talk into it. Or if you're on the telephone, I'll take your telephone off the hook. And then we'll talk. And when we're finished, I may mute you or may not, for example, or throw them open to the audience. I'm here. I can pretend that I know what the hell I'm talking about. And or if anybody just wants to say hello, that's also good. And excuse me, I'm going to drink my fiery alcoholic ginger beer. In the meantime. Okay. No problems. So anybody doing anything exciting at the moment? I've been spending the week working on reviewing data center designs, getting awfully familiar with Nexus 7000, 5000, and 2000. It's getting very weird. I'm not sure what I think of them. Yeah, somebody's saying the sound is so-so. I'm not sure why. It might be my internet connection is playing up. Some people said that it was a problem.
Yeah, it's probably your internet connection.
Is it very crackly, Ivan?
I hope you're recording on your end because you are disappearing every now and then.
Okay. Well, hopefully somebody else will talk in a minute and see some things. Usually the only way for me to fix this is to reboot my router, and sometimes it comes better, but sometimes it doesn't. What have you been working on, Ivan? You've been having a quiet time lately.
Vacation, come on.
Are you still on vacation?
So you haven't noticed I'm on vacation?
Yes, no, I did. I saw you when you came somewhere in on Tuesday that you were on vacation. A long vacation?
Well, officially I was on vacation since I was planning to sort of disappear for the whole summer, and of course it's not working out because I'm so bored.
That's the problem with boredom.
So I'm researching a little bit, writing a little bit, getting crazy about stupid vendors.
Yeah.
For example, a vendor just launched an API on a platform with the new SOTS release that came out last Friday.
Yeah.
And you know what that API can do? It can do screen scraping.
Why would you bother with that?
You execute the show command through a CLI function, and then you get the output, and then you parse the output yourself. Isn't that great API?
That's not an API. What are they just putting the CLI into XML or something?
No, it's not XML. It's a Python script running on the switch.
That kind of sounds like screen scraping from AS400s and mainframes that was done years ago.
Exactly.
It's like swings and roundabouts. It's back again.
Oh, yeah, that same vendor is supporting netconf, and they return the results of the show printout in XML envelope. And you can still screen scrape the results.
Why would you? That sounds like just lame. That's saying yes, we've got an SDN strategy without actually doing it. Surely.
Yes.
That's not.
But honestly, this was way before. This started way before SDN. They had the so-called XML API for a few years.
Oh, okay.
Ivan, screen scraping started way before that anyway.
Oh, yeah, we were doing screen scraping in the 80s.
I remember my last job in the in Australia was installing a IBM OS2 Communications Manager that was dealing with screen scraping from AS400s and
IBM. Oh, I'm so sorry hard. To hear that.
That isn't what scared me away from home.
By the way, do you know that Cisco had a screen scraping application running on the SIP plate in Cisco 7000?
Sorry, the screen
could convert, you know, the 30.
Yeah, go on.
Well, Cisco had this channel attachment blade for Cisco 7000.
Right. Yeah.
And first it was SNA only, and then they added IP, and then they added Telnet 3270 converter onto it. And the last thing they did was they had a screen scraping application.
Oh, yeah, I remember those. Yes. We used to write a lot of those ourselves back in the old days in Tickle and Perl. Tickle for the screen part and then Perl to munge it. So, but it wasn't really a, it wasn't doing
what a
real
fabulous
stuff.
Word.
Mm.
Well, and we've progressed immensely in the last 15 years because instead of Perl, now they're using Python.
Well, that's not exactly progress. Keith Miller, you've got a question. I've unmuted you if you want to ask.
Yes, Greg. I appreciate you guys taking the time to take my question. First of all, my name is Keith Miller. I'm a network administrator in South Carolina on an Air Force base.
Uh-huh.
And I had a issue on Friday where a directly connected route was up and up. It showed up in the routing table, yet EIGRP was not pulling that route from the routing table and putting it into its topology database. Therefore, it wasn't sending an update to its peers with that route. I didn't understand why it wasn't doing that, but just a simple no shut on the interface was able to fix the issue, and the route was put into the topology database and therefore sent an update to its peers. Has anybody ever seen that before?
Yeah, that would be called, Cisco would call that a feature, not a bug.
Undocumented feature.
Yeah, wow.
Undocumented, unwanted.
Yeah.
So did you inspect the topology table whether the same route coming from somewhere else was maybe stuck inactive or something?
Well, this particular route was only coming from this particular switch. So this would have been the only switch that had that route unless it was being updated to its peers. And I know for sure that it wasn't being updated because I couldn't ping from the source of that interface, and I also couldn't reach it from across the network. So just on a hunch, I decided to check the EIGRP database, even did an all links on it just to see if there was a route in there that wasn't a successor, a feasible successor, and there was nothing there at all.
Crazy.
I thought so myself, but yeah, I posed the question in the IRC channel when I got back from the site to see if anybody had heard of it before. I believe Scott McDermott said that he saw an issue similar to that before where a shut to fix the issue as well.
Vaguely remember something like that a while ago. But
things like that happen.
It definitely sounds like a bug to me.
So first thing I think of is a bug. The couple of things that I would think of, one is that EIGRP is being used less and less, and because customers are using it less, there's less bugs being reported back to Cisco, and because the bugs aren't being reported to Cisco, Cisco's not fixing anything, and or bugs are creeping into the EIGRP code because Cisco relies on customers to report bugs to find them because they're not very good at finding them themselves. So quite commonly you get these types of things, little niggly bugs that don't sort of show up in normal testing or Cisco's testing, and they'll stay in. And that's been common in EIGRP for 10 years or more. So,
do we know what routing protocol Cisco uses internally?
It's a good question.
I don't think it really matters.
I'm just curious.
I know that most customers are now moving towards OSPF, and because we move towards OSPF, that's where the bugs are found. That's where most of the testing dollars are focused inside of Cisco. So, you know, would you use EIGRP? Whereas years ago, everybody used EIGRP and not OSPF, and the OSPF code, what, back at, say, 2004, 2005, the OSPF code was really not great, and you wanted to use EIGRP just because the OSPF wasn't very good and had this sort of problems in it. Nowadays, it's flipped over. As people switch over to OSPF, EIGRP code is going downhill. I've had weird things with EIGRP and a reboot, or as you say, a shut, no shut, resets a process and away it goes again. So,
just to come back with that, Greg, I'm not sure how things are nationally, even globally, but here on base, we're a Cisco-centric shop, so EIGRP was basically the choice to go with for a routing protocol. I've interviewed at a couple of different companies over the last week or so, and they're all looking for someone who's got a lot of experience with EIGRP because that's what they're running on there as their IGP protocol. So, like I said, I'm not sure what's being used out in the rest of the world, but I'm still seeing a lot of EIGRP, at least here in South Carolina. Big Greg die.
No, he's digesting the information, though.
So for me, in the last 5 years, I haven't seen only one customer out of, say, 8 or 9 have been using EIGRP. Most people have switched to OSPF because the pain of, like, things like if you want to talk to an IBM mainframe and you've got 2 Ethernet interfaces, they use OSPF to do route selection on each of the interfaces. And so then you have to do an OSPF to EIGRP redistribution. Or if you're working with checkpoint firewalls, they use OSPF. They don't do EIGRP, and you want to inject routes. Or if you want to work with anybody's third-party equipment, they all support OSPF, and they don't support EIGRP. And so for that reason, most people are tending towards using OSPF so they can interoperate if and when they need to do so. And it's not like you need to do it in the core of your network. It's only at the edges where, you know, mainframes or weird bits of equipment or interoperating with third parties or, you know, B2Bing to external parties.
Yeah, Greg, the other thing is also you work primarily in data center environment. And if I would start from, let's say, semi-scratch in the last 10 years or so and start building my data center, I would use OSPF.
Yes.
But if I'm an enterprise WAN network, for example, running EIGRP, and if I don't want to switch vendors, there is no reason to go and redesign the whole WAN network just so I can use the other routing protocol.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree.
Right. And I think that's kind of the position we're in. We're an enterprise campus network, and we're Cisco-centric, like I said, and the network was built off of EIGRP, and we just haven't had any reasons to switch to OSPF. You know, Cisco ASAs use EIGRP, and all of our switches are Cisco, so they can all run EIGRP as well.
Well, they do now. They didn't in the first few versions of code, not until version 8. So Cisco only put the EIGRP in.
That's well before my time.
Lucky you. You got the ones that actually have all the features inside and working.
This is Priscilla. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Hello, Priscilla. How are you doing?
I'm still seeing a lot of EIGRP, but I work with hello. Good. I work with almost all Cisco customers. But I'm still seeing a lot of EIGRP. It might just be because it would be so difficult to get rid of it at this point. They started with it 10, 15 years ago. But I'm still seeing a lot of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought I would have seen more of it because I know how much of it I rolled out in the early 2000s and late 90s. EIGRP was everywhere. Maybe it's just me then.
I also wanted to quickly say thank you for putting this on. It's Sunday morning here, and my husband and I are going to go for a hike, so I'm going to be signing off, but thank you for putting this on.
I just thought it would be fun. I was supposed to record, and I thought, well, just let's get together.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. try and build some community around networking, because sometimes we don't have it. I hope you have a good hike.
All right. Well, thank you.
See ya.
See ya.
Here's one. Talking about firewalls, specifically the ASAs, has anyone had any experience using redundant interfaces?
If anybody's got an answer to that question, you can just throw your hand up, and I'll do my best. I haven't. I've always used Active Standby.
Yeah, not for the actual devices themselves, but the interfaces, like bundling two interfaces, much like a...
You mean LACP?
The config is basically just setting a redundant pair of interfaces, like GI00 and GI01 as one interface with an active passive on the actual interface. So they'll go off to two separate devices. If one of those devices should go down, then it'll keep talking to the other one.
Yeah, I've seen that feature, but that assumes that you don't have redundant. I've normally got a redundant ASA, so you have an active and a standby, and the active connected to this switch, and the standby is connected to that switch. So I wouldn't use the redundant interface feature normally.
The only drawback on that I would have seen would be if, I've got two redundant pairs of firewalls, and if one of those goes down, going to a switch stack, so you got the switch stack, firewall stack, firewall pair, and another firewall pair. So if one of the devices goes down, you want it to keep talking, and it's the only way I could work out that, basically, if any device went down, it'd keep talking, even if two devices went down.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Normally, I would configure the active ASA with interface tracking, and so or some sort of SLA interface. And so if the upstream switch goes down but the active firewall doesn't, it still fails over to the secondary. The redundant interface feature is only used when you've got a single, or at least my understanding, I could be wrong, is that redundant interface is only needed when you've got one firewall and you need to connect it to two switches. And you need to fail over. So the upstream switch, you fail over to the second switch.
But now you or Greg, if your CFO is overly smart and wants to know why you bought two firewalls and you're only using one.
Yeah.
And then you deploy them in active-active configuration and you don't want a single interface failure to cut your bandwidth in half.
I had issues doing that on active-active.
Yeah,
Didn't want to play.
That would be. I would have to double check that feature works in virtual contexts.
No idea.
Yeah, because when you use virtual contexts on ASAs, you have lots of interesting problems. If you've never used virtual contexts on ASAs, you've only ever used them in normal mode. All features work in the standard mode, and when you use context mode. Lots of features don't work, like routing protocols and VPN and I think redundant, little things. Redundant interfaces might be one of those, although who knows what's happening in the later versions of code.
Yeah, I've got 8.4.6, I think, is what I'm currently using.
Yeah, I'd have to go.
The other one, along with the multiple contexts, is if you go and use those in transparent mode, it drops a whole bunch of functionality as well.
Yes. So the Cisco firewalls have always been the transparent mode in the ASA was always put on later. So it wasn't part of the initial design. So it's sort of... has
an
never
add-on
been...
That wasn't quite not, integrated.
Yes, hasn't been... My experiences of that have never been... great. So the stories that I've heard from other people around the place is that using layer 2 on the ASA or the FWSMs is perhaps best avoided in the general use case.
Yeah, I did initially look at putting these in transparently, and then just the way things were implemented, it just was not feasible and too confusing.
Yeah. Well, since I'm not drawing anything. CJ, I've unmuted you. You've got a question about ISIS?
Oh, yeah, when you guys were talking about EIGRP, I was just wondering if you guys think ISIS is going to start creeping into the enterprise at all.
No.
Just to... Yeah, I don't think so.
Of course it will.
I mean,
Thrill runs on ISIS.
I was just going to say, is the new protocol running it? But you never have to touch ISIS, though, do you?
You don't. unless something breaks and then you have a problem.
Yeah, but you wouldn't call ISIS and Trill ISIS, it's Trill. You won't see it as a different thing. You won't configure it as, you know, router ISIS 10, for example.
Well, you just configured Trill, but the problem is once something breaks, what will you do?
Well, you don't see anything. There's no commands to see the Trill database or anything like that. Maybe in the future.
Something, but okay, whatever.
Yeah, it's pretty limited. Like,
yeah,
you can see the topology and that's it. It's not then. There's no variables you can fiddle with at the moment, I don't think, even.
Do you think it's worth people who work in the enterprise to start learning it, though? Maybe.
I think that for the same reason that we use EIGRP and OSPF, there's not a lot of value in using ISIS for an enterprise because you're not normally big enough. Ivan, you're probably better to speak to this, but ISIS is used by service providers because they can have multiple layer 2, L1, L2. So where OSPF can only have
No one is using that.
No?
The problem is that if you're using level 1 and level 2, then you have all sorts of issues with route leaking and default route and so on.
Right.
So a lot of people are just configuring ISIS in level 2 and that's it.
Well, that makes
and
sense.
It scales to a few hundred routers, so who cares?
Yeah. And having a few hundred routers in a single autonomous system is actually quite a lot of routers, really.
Particularly if they are CRSs or something like that.
That's right, yeah, the really big stable ones. So, and the flip side of this, of course, is that Cisco's certifications and educationally, most people in enterprise are only aware of OSPF, EIGRP, and RIP. And for them to make a decision to go with ISIS and feel like they have to learn a new protocol would be a lot of work. And I don't think people would do that.
The new routes exam doesn't have RIP, I think. I mean, it's just OSPF, EIGRP, and BGP.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Honestly, I don't think I've ever seen ISIS in the enterprise.
I've seen it in WAN backbones, in MPLS WANs.
No, not even there. Not in the enterprise environment.
Yeah. But that was just one or two use cases for that were quite, you know, somebody thought you needed ISIS maybe for everyone.
Greg, you know where that came from. More than a decade ago, there was this OSI profile, and people thought that OSI will be the primary protocol, and maybe IP will run in parallel with that.
Yeah, go SIP.
So in those days, it would make sense to use ISIS in, let's say, a government environment.
Mm.
And then, as we discussed before, you never migrate because it just works.
Yeah, yeah. I think, CJ, one of the other things is that ISIS actually costs more, too. It used to be free, but now it's part of the service provider feature set, and you have to buy licenses for it. So that'll keep it.
And you don't get it on the switches.
Yep.
At least not all of them.
No.
And definitely not for free.
On the flip side, ISIS code does get quite a lot of testing because it's used in the service provider market on certain pieces of hardware, not on all.
Yeah, and some people are really crazy and build huge, flat ISIS networks, so the code is optimized for those people.
Yes.
Well, if that's the only place they're getting bug reports from.
Yeah. And by the way, that explains why ISIS code was so much better than OSPF code years ago.
Yes. So a couple, I don't know if anybody else has noticed, but this week Microsoft has announced that they're going to revamp their encryption keys, and the next generation, next set of updates to Windows operating system will reject encryption keys smaller than 1024 bits, which probably means that a lot of us using self-generate.
It's going to break a lot of stuff.
Yes. I was thinking about that. I was thinking there's a lot of self-signed certificates where you've just done something internally just to get an SSL going, and that's going to break because there's a lot of 512 bits and 768-bit SSL encrypted keys done 5 years ago that probably need to be redone.
But, Greg, surely that doesn't sound very familiar from Microsoft, does it?
No. Well, bit of a weird one. I think that's a bit interesting. Because the Flame malware was able to use a collision attack and compromise certain of Microsoft's encryption keys of their own. And they've since invalidated 30 certificates, so that's been quite entertaining.
Wow. That's quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, the new route exam is literally only EIGRP, OSPF, and BGP, and IPv6.
Mm.
Makes perfect sense.
Well, I mean, the one previous to that, the BSCI, was covering RIP, ISIS, and some other bits and pieces as well that were a little redundant.
Well, RIP would only be useful today if you're running DMVPN with huge fan-out ratio.
Or six routers.
Or what?
Only six routers. Very, very, very small.
Now, if you have like over 1,000 spokes per hub, then RIP would save the day if you don't want to go with BGP. But that's the only use case I see for RIP today.
Yeah, RIP's over. Just anybody who's joined a bit late, if you want to ask a question, just type a question into the chat window and then I'll unmute your microphone and you can ask any question that you wish. More than pleased to take any questions. One of the interesting things I saw this week was General Motors is going to kill off their outsourcing. I don't know if anybody saw this, but General Motors is taking a $3 billion outsourcing contract and 90% of its services back in-house.
Hey.
Which is pretty
and
serious.
Then they will cloudify them?
Well, they're
and
gonna,
then they'll go out again.
Well, it's going to be pretty interesting because a lot of companies have been outsourcing for the last 5 years and then finding out that it's really not working quite the way they expected.
When you look back and do the calculation, you're usually wasting money with outsourcing.
I was working for JP Morgan Chase 10 years ago, and at one stage I was contracted directly to JP Morgan Chase, and then they outsourced to IBM, so we got moved to IBM, and then within a year and a half they started moving us all back in-house, and it's just kind of, what's all this waste of money? You've gone out, you've come back in.
Now, the problem they were trying to solve with outsourcing is that, when you were in, you were fixed cost.
Mm.
And then when they moved you out, they could pretend it's variable cost. So it's no longer fixed. They only pay as much as they use you. On the other hand, IBM wanted to have some markup on that. So in the end, you were doing the same thing, but you cost them more. But in theory, it was variable.
But they'd also have SLAs. I'm sure they could make money from as well as the actual process, the business processes regarding change control and all the rest. So that would be handled extremely differently, outsourcing as opposed to insourcing.
Well, there's the experience I have of outsourcing is that it was people didn't write very good contracts, so what was given away didn't work very well. You know, they're like, I've seen outsourcing contracts where they gave away all of IT, and then the partner on the other side got rid of its architecture team and its design assurance and all that sort of stuff, and all they did was operate the network so they could make a profit. That didn't work very well because they didn't know how to upgrade the network. I've seen other people outsource the network in chunks, so 2, 3, 4 suppliers, and these people are managing the Windows servers and these people are managing the Unix servers. This company's handling the network and the WAN, the data center and the WAN, and they're all not cooperating very well. So I've sort of got this view that companies aren't used to cooperating. They're too busy competing with each other to get new business for it to be. And then you've always got contracts where people desperate to, make a profit and say, well, we're only going to do what's written in the contract. We're not going to do any more, and we're certainly going to do as little as possible to make sure we get as much money as possible. And outsourcing tends to fall down a little bit when that sort of attitude creeps in. Chris Church, you've got a question?
Yeah, it was more of a comment, Greg, on the outsourcing. Yeah. Outsourcing is a hot political topic right now here in the United States, and it just so happens that the government here has a significant investment in General Motors. So I find it interesting that GM makes an announcement about bringing more services in-house, right here during election time. It smells of politics, if you ask me. That's just basically my only comment.
Hey, yes. Keith Miller again. I guess just to keep the discussion going, I only have about 2 years of experience, and I just got my CCNP last September. I know there's quite a few people out there that are going for their CCIE right now, and even a few people that are in the same situation as me with the amount of years of experience. And I was just wondering what some of you guys who already have your CCIE think. Should we wait and get more experience under our belt before going for the CCIE, or do you think that it's a good idea to just keep going?
Keep going. Don't stop. Get experience if you can. It makes it easier. But the CCIE exam, in a funny sort of a way, if you've actually got experience, it can make it harder for you because the CCIE... The CCIE exam is actually not real life, okay? The things that you do in your CCIE learning and study is, there's some things in there like, when I was doing mine 10 years ago, we had to redistribute IGRP, not EIGRP, the one before that, IGRP, into OSPF. And even in 2001, IGRP was not common, but the point was they wanted you to understand how to redistribute a class list protocol into a class full protocol, and more importantly, into a stateful class full protocol. And so those things never change. So my advice would be just keep going. Having practical experience makes it easier because it helps you to learn some of the stuff. But other times it gets in the way because you'd be sitting there going, why am I learning this stuff? Because it's absolutely useless. If that makes any sense. I don't know about you, Ivan. What do you think?
I mean, it kind of helps having the experience, I think.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Knowledge is always good. Sorry, Adam, go on.
I think in some ways experience can help in that it's a methodology of thinking. If you're already thinking the kind of outside the box, sorry to use a cliche like that, but for that kind of, XYZ kind of problem, and that's what you do on your day-to-day, it'll certainly help for troubleshooting, I'm sure.
Well, what I would say is that actually you have to focus on understanding how things work. because a lot of people are just going through all this, you know, prep materials, and they're trying to memorize the commands, and they're trying to improve their typing skills, and they don't actually understand how things work. So it's hard to extrapolate from what you have to where you want to be or whatever it is. Once you understand how things work, they're way easier to remember. They're way easier to implement. They're way easier to troubleshoot.
I think studying and working kind of go hand in hand, because while you study, you could study a particular topic one night and then you go into work and you end up working on that topic the next day. That always seems to happen with me anyways. And I think you can't do one without the other. You really should kind of be doing both simultaneously.
I definitely agree with that. While I was studying for the CCNP route exam, there were a couple of solutions that came out of that, like setting up stub routers and EIGRP, since a lot of our buildings didn't need to know all the routes, and we were having some issues with adjacencies dropping because of a big query domain. I was able to basically suggest that solution, and I think it's worked out pretty well. So I definitely agree that while you're studying, you can definitely get some good ideas on how to help with your current day-to-day job.
Yeah, that's ideal, but you will always have topics that you've never seen in real life, like, I don't know, IP multicast.
Yeah, well, that's the curse.
Well, in our days, it was Apple Talk. Today, it's IP multicast.
Yeah, or Apollo XNS or something equally weird. SSM
but
multicast.
Those weren't in the exam.
No.
Apple Talk was. And there was a big chunk of the exam was Apple Talk.
I mean, for instance, I've just gone through a whole lot of firewall stuff, redesigning a firewall connection. And when I went and had a look at the actual requirements for the firewall exam that I'm going to be doing later on in the year, I've already covered 2/3 of that just implementing now. So that's kind of handy doing that now.
Oh, just make sure that you go through all the materials before you go to the exam, because you have to know the official religion.
Yeah. I wasn't planning on skipping the material.
Because I know some exams from Cisco are really good, and they actually test your understanding, and some are more focused toward what's in the study guide or in the course or whatever, wherever it is. And in that case, it helps if you know what's written in there.
Yeah, Cisco training is very good at teaching you to think, or they encourage you to think and to learn. So they ask you questions about OSPF that challenge your understanding of how it works. So, all right, well, that's 54 minutes. I think we've pretty much done a hangout for tonight. Has anybody else got any questions? We've answered Keith Miller's. Otherwise, I think we'll wrap it up and say thanks for joining in on a Packet Pushers Packet Party for no apparent reason. As always, you can find us on the podcast website. Follow us on the Twitter.